Welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. We've got a not a fun show today, but certainly one that I think most people should listen to and be aware of. You know, there's two things in life that are inevitable: death and taxes. The other one is a long-term illness, the possibility that you will be disabled or otherwise laid low by a crippling, devastating disease or affliction or action. And I wanted to talk about that a little bit today, and I'm sort of the, in some ways, the poster boy for long-term care insurance, because my mother, longtime government worker, died several years ago. She had been hale and hearty all her life. I think she didn't have a car until she was in her 40s. She didn't drive, so she was a city gal and a walker. And it was the last few years that dementia laid her low and was just absolutely devastating. It was a difficult thing to see. But one of the saving graces for myself as the only child and my grandchildren, who were very, very helpful, was the fact that she not only had a federal civil service annuity and she had Social Security, but she also had long-term care insurance. She wouldn't get it through the government program, as I suggested, but that's mothers and sons do that sort of thing, you know. But she did get it, and between her federal annuity, her Social Security, and her long-term care insurance, we, the family, had very little out of pocket. And I think even most importantly, she had a very good, if you can call having dementia anything good about it, she had as comfortable and as dignified a care as you could find. And I was always so grateful that she got it. And more recently, another family member has gone into long-term care at about age 68, probably. And it's not the kind of thing you expect, but it's something that's out there. Now, we're not trying to push any particular plan today, any particular show. One of the problems is finding an insurance company that will offer you long-term care insurance. When I got mine a long, long time ago, probably some people would say I got it too early, but I'm a belt and suspenders guy. And when I got long-term care insurance, there were a number of companies, and it was easy to pick, and people said, you know, you're getting it too soon, you're wasting your premiums, and, well, this is one premium I hope is wasted forever. I hope I never collect on long-term care insurance. But the point is that the plan that I joined no longer offers long-term care insurance. I got it through the Washington Post group plan. They continue to cover those of us who signed up, but they're not taking any new people, and that tells you something about how expensive long-term care is. My guest today is Joan Melanson. She is with the Federal Long-Term Care Partners Program. You guys are based in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And Joan, I was kidding you before the showtime. Have you dug out of the snow yet?
Oh, barely, Mike. Thank you very much. It has been a brutal winter, and we shattered all records of snowfall in this area. And I still have banks of snow in my yard. I live in Massachusetts, and the little buds of the bulbs I've planted are starting to sprout out. But it's been a brutal winter, and we finally are getting some warm weather, and everybody's smiling here.
Thank you.
So
yeah,
that's good.
Very good. Those who survived, huh? Joan, can you explain something? You guys run the long-term care insurance program for the federal government, correct?
Yes, we do, since 2002.
How many people are enrolled in your program?
We have now over 272,000, and that would be employees plus annuitants, as well as members of the military, active military and retired. So this is open very broadly, and many of the federal programs do not cover the military segment, so we also work with them.
Well, you know, that sounds like a lot, and it is a lot, but given the size of the government and the size of the retiree community, you hope that some of those people have long-term care insurance elsewhere, because otherwise that's about 1 in 10.
Well, you know, Mike, our charter, and we're regulated and supervised by the Office of Personnel Management, our charter is to educate people on having a plan for long-term care. We don't go out saying long-term care insurance is what you should have. We go out and say the important thing is to have a plan. You know, people spend so much time on retirement, or some people do. They say people spend more time planning their vacations than planning for retirement. And by the way, this is national retirement planning week, and we're very supportive, and our charter is to support OPM's financial literacy initiative. We want people to plan for long-term care like they plan for other pieces of their retirement. They look at their Social Security, how much will I be getting? And if I defer it, how much bigger would that benefit be? What's my annuity? What's my TSP? I'm looking at all those pieces, and people presumably are, but they also do need to look at the fact that once retirement happens, early 60s or maybe later, I don't know if you're ever going to retire, Mike.
As soon as I hit my 60s, I'll start thinking about it.
Yeah. You and I have a deal. We're not getting any older.
Right.
We're counting backwards now.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have people retiring in their 60s. The reality today is once you hit 65 and you don't have any kind of a debilitating disease like MS or Parkinson's, you have a very high probability of living 30 plus more years. And I can't tell you that, but you may not live in the state in which you would like to live.
Yeah.
But you've got 30 years to deal with that. This wasn't the case before when people retired. They basically would retire, they'd live in retirement for a few years, and it would be over. But now people are living for a long time. And so in the planning aspect, LTC, long-term care, is an important component. What are your plans for long-term care? What are your plans if something were to happen to you within that 30-year window or however long you might live? And insurance may or may not be a solution for you.
Well,
but if you decide it is, we've got a great program, but there are other private plans as well.
Sure. Well, when they started Social Security in this country in the 1930s, and in Germany, they started it much earlier. I think under Bismarck, they had some sort of thing. But one of the first things the planners did was say, how long does the average person live? And they said, okay, 62 in those days.
Absolutely.
And so they said, okay, let's make the age to collect 65. And it seemed like a good idea at the time, but they didn't have to pay out much money. But that has changed. And I think this month, I have read three or four obituaries in the Washington Post. These are about Washington area people who were in their 90s and who were retired for more than 30 years.
Absolutely. Well, that just supports what I said. And it's not atypical to see people in their 90s and even people in their hundreds living. And so things are changing. And my mom passed away as well. She dealt with Alzheimer's for a number of years. She passed this past August when she was 92. In fact, we've got the service for her in June because she was herself a World War II vet, and my dad is already at Arlington, and I'm really looking forward to the full honors service there because, you know, this is the passing of a great generation.
Yeah, I think they're losing 1,100 a day or something like that. It's remarkable.
It is, and big loss for me, just like you mentioned, the loss of your mom and going through the same Alzheimer's experience for many years, watching that happen.
Well, the great thing about the fact that she had long-term care insurance, and again, it wasn't the government program, but it was a program, was it enabled me and my grandchildren and her grandchildren to put her in a very fine facility that, you know, almost anybody would want to go to under different circumstances. So that was a blessing for us to feel good. But when she was lucid, she realized that it could have been much, much worse. I wanted to ask you the difference, long-term disability versus long-term care. Who needs what?
Oh, you're absolutely right. We get that question all the time because people are so insuranced out.
Yeah.
Think of it, and you think, gee, I must have something in all this money I pay out that's going to cover my long-term care needs. But long-term disability is only when you're working. So if you all of a sudden are disabled, that insurance will cover your salary, some percentage of it, usually, you know, 100% for a while, and then it moves down to 75%, depending upon your plan.
Yeah.
It will replace your salary, but it's not long-term care, which is very, very different. That's
right.
Salary replacement while you're working. And that will go away. I have it myself, and it will go away when I no longer work.
Okay. Now, long-term care insurance, on the other hand, is a different breed of cat. And we need to take a short break here, talking with Joan Melanson from the Federal Long-Term Care Program. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Joan Melanson. She is director of the program promotion for Long-Term Care Partners, and this is the group that the government has partnered with to offer its employees and retirees, and you said military people as well?
Absolutely.
To offer them long-term care insurance through the government, and it's not the only long-term care program around by far, but as a point I made in the earlier segment, is I got my long-term care insurance 15 years ago, probably, maybe even more, it's Washington Post. I was way too, quote, young to get it, according to most people's standards, but I'm glad I did. Got it with a good company that was affiliated with the Washington Post program, and they now no longer offer long-term care insurance. Now, they've kept me in the cohort that I was in, so all of my colleagues at that time who enrolled will continue to be covered by them and pay our premiums to them, but new people can't get in. The company won't take anymore. That tells you something, doesn't it, Joan?
It does. You know, when a market starts out, and this is not only true for long-term care insurance, but in general, when there's a new market, a lot of companies jump in. And that was true of this insurance market. There were, back when I first started the late 80s, there were over 100 companies that were selling this product. But over time, for this market and for others, there becomes consolidation, and you have the real committed and the financially solid companies remaining. And actually, this market started in the 70s. But, you know, now you're finding more of like a dozen carriers that are committed and have really looked at the market to see what are the claims, how do we price this product, and so forth, because the whole idea is that you want to pay the claims that you're promising. Insurance is about promises made now for delivery many years down the pike. And in this particular market, they've got to price out 30, 40, 50 years, and the conditions are so unknown. You can see all the changes in terms of delivery of long-term care services.
Yeah, I used to have a friend who talked about, he said the 20th century, really the latter part of it, was the first time that you saw a lot of people with gray hair. It was the first time that many people grew up to have grandparents who were still alive, and how mortality at birth, how many women died early, and once they more or less solved that problem, the age gap changed, and now women are outliving men. But a lot of things have changed in our lifetime, and the insurance companies, and nobody could have anticipated the results of this, but people are getting living longer now and getting diseases associated with old age and also things like falls.
You're absolutely right, and things have changed a lot. There are also changes, you know, in terms of how long people are living. People used to die of heart attacks and strokes, and we patch people back together. It's no wonder we're going to see more people living longer with cognitive issues such as Alzheimer's, because the medical stuff has been solved, but they can't for some reason, although there have been some promising breakthroughs, can't seem to figure out a pill for curing dementia, even though they understand how the plaque works and the brain,
right,
and all of that. I, you know, I'm just waiting for that big breakthrough moment, and that's really going to change everything.
Yeah. Well, Joan, when you're looking at the possibility of getting this, I've heard people say, look, I've got a federal annuity, I've got Social Security, I'm going to have Medicare. I don't need long-term care insurance, but in fact, they do, don't they?
Well, they do, because Medicare is really a synonym for health care. And health care is the care that you receive when you're getting better. When you stop getting better, Medicare says, we can no longer help you. And I witnessed that with my mom, because right at about day 24 or 23, because 21 is usually about the average, 20, 21, where they're paying some percentage of the care. First 20 days, 100%, and then it's 80%. They said, sorry, but your mom isn't getting any better. And starting tomorrow, you pay the full freight, because they will no longer pay. So you then move to a self-pay situation, which my mom did not have long-term care insurance. You know, we were paying out of pocket at a nursing home for $160,000 a year. semi-private room. And so we were paying that to cover those almost 3 years in the nursing home. And that's after we took care of her at home for many years, because, you know, Alzheimer's is takes care over a long period of time.
Well, and it really beats up the caregiver, too. There are all sorts of studies that show that after the person with the disease dies, the caregiver is sort of left hanging out there, and maybe doesn't last longer, but they're in a very weakened, you know, physical, emotional state.
Well, it's a lot of work, even if you have a person at home and you have people coming in, because they don't cover 24/7. It becomes very, very expensive, as you're saying. So even if you have some help, which insurance will alleviate some of the financial strains if you have somebody coming in, which also helps emotionally and physically. But even if you're looking at a facility situation, when you visit all the time and when you manage the care, whether it's at home or an assisted living care facility or a nursing home, that still takes a lot out of the person who's responsible. So it isn't just a matter, and maybe some people just put their parents or put their loved ones in a nursing home and wipe their hands of it.
Yeah.
But I know I was very, very involved with my mom, and it took an awful big toll, even though I had care for her close by.
I think about 25% of the people that I know of a certain age are involved in long-term care. Either they're getting it or they're a caregiver or somebody in the families. I was surprised you sent me some numbers as to how relatively few people go into nursing homes.
Well, in our program, we have a very wonderful home health care benefit. And I sort of view this insurance, the Federal Long-Term Care Insurance Program, as the anti-nursing home mm-hmm. insurance, because there you can receive care at home in an assisted living care facility. And the services you can receive, whether they're licensed home health care providers or they're informal care providers, meaning family members or friends, family members not living with you at the time, but who come in and maybe decide to live with you and take care of you. Having those kinds of benefits enable people to stay at home longer. Stay-at-home benefit, you can use some monies during the deductible, the waiting period, to make home renovations, which will mean that you can stay at your home. So we do a lot of things, because all studies show that people want to remain in their homes. They don't want to go to a nursing home. So, and they don't need to if they can get the proper support. So a lot of care is received at home, over 50% at home, and over about a third in assisted living care facilities. People seem to like to go there. They're not the same as nursing homes, and about 13% nursing homes. So we do a lot to meet the needs of federal family members, and we try to keep people aging in place, which is where they want to remain.
I have a friend, a retired federal worker, and we have lunch about every other week, and his mother has dementia, Alzheimer's. They're never quite sure what it is until they do an autopsy, but she mm-hmm. has something, and his father doesn't, but his father is equally as old or older. They live in New England, and he drives up once a month, stays for a week, and sort of spells everybody. His brothers are there, his father is there. And the deal they have is that the father watches TV late at night on purpose, goes to bed late, gets up at 12 or 1, and mm-hmm. his mother is good in the morning. And he mentioned mm-hmm. something.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I wanted to call it sunset, or there's some terminology, but it sort of deteriorates in the afternoon mm-hmm. and the evening, and they mm-hmm. become different, disoriented, and fearful of the dark. And I wanted to ask you about that when we take a break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Joan Melanson. She is with Long-Term Care Partners. And Joan, you, the note here says, are you in an abandoned Air Force base even as we speak?
Yes, it's the former Pease Air Force Base. And, you know, and the travels, and I talk to feds, civilians and military all the time. It's amazing the number of people that have gone through Pease Air Force Base. And so I haven't been there in 20 or 30 years.
I've heard of it, yeah.
You won't believe what it looks like now. It's one of the big success stories of taking an Air Force base that was closed and turning it into a trade port. We have a hotel here. We have a community college, Great Bay Community College, all kinds of businesses and so forth. So we have a nice office space here nestled among the trees. So we're not downtown Portsmouth. We're off on the side here, but that's where we're located.
Beating swords into plowshares or condos or something. Oh, that's good. Good. Yeah. You know, before the break, we were talking about my friend, retired Fed. He got long-term care insurance for himself. I think his parents got it as well. But he goes up to New England 1 week a month, spells his brothers, spells his father, and their situation is such that the father takes care of her in the mornings when she's lucid and happy and fun, and then they sort of have help come in the afternoon, because that there is some syndrome where people get worse in the afternoon. And I think some psychologists think it's even a primitive fear of darkness that maybe comes back to us, but for some reason they get restless, they need to be calm and whatnot. And they had long-term care insurance, and he said it has been a godsend, because one of the brothers or one of the sisters-in-law can get some money from the long-term care insurance to sort of augment whatever other income they have. But you actually have a loving, caring family member taking care of the person who's ill.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great if you can get family members involved like that, because Alzheimer's requires 24/7 because of the wandering and so forth. But many family members are not located nearby. They're also not as, you know, they've got, everybody has busy lives. And, you know, if I said to anybody I meet, you know, what's your life like? And they'll say, I'm running around all the time. Nobody has time to add caregiving in at all. Nobody does. But you know what? If you have to do it, you do it. And getting back to the comment you made about 25% of people being caregivers, I'll never forget a quote that Rosalind Carter made years ago. She said, there are only four types of people in this world. Those people who have been caregivers, those people who are currently caregiving for somebody, those people who will be caregivers, and the final one, which is the icky one that you started the show off with, is who might be your caregiver if you need one. And, you know, that's the reality of it, is that as we go through life, we assume different roles. And life becomes full circle. And I was very struck by that comment, because it's the people that have been through the caregiving experience that really get it. And it does open your eyes, and you start thinking, you know, do I want my kids to take care of me? And how will that impact their lives, particularly if I had Alzheimer's and needed help 24/7? And are they just going to, I want them to just throw their lives away and say, okay, Mom, I'm coming up and taking care of you. I don't think that's not what I want for my kids.
Well, to slice and dice that about I remember many, many years ago, somebody said, be nice to your daughters-in-law because they will pick your nursing home. And boy, I've seen that in action since. Joan, actual benefits themselves and premiums. Is there a website people could go to and look at your program, the government program?
Absolutely. It's a very comprehensive website. It's www.ltcfeds.com. LTC for long-term care, feds.com. We have not only information about the federal benefit, the FELTSIP, but there's a lot of information about long-term care in general, just to educate people. In addition to that, we have a very comprehensive webinar program, because as I mentioned before, we support OPM's financial literacy initiative. And our webinars, and we just launched our new spring webinar series, it isn't just about long-term care. We talk about maximizing your Social Security benefit. We talk about maximizing your federal benefits. We do mid-career training. We do 6 key retirement decisions you can't afford to ignore. We do Medicare and FEHB, caregiving. Am I saving enough for retirement? We have a very wide selection of topics, and we bring in expert speakers from all over to talk about these topics, and we sponsor them because we want to show how long-term care planning and long-term care insurance fit into the whole big picture. Because when you put things within context, it makes a lot more sense.
Well, Julia Ziegler is doing our producing today, and maybe we can put a link to that in the column so people could go to it, because there are a lot of times you don't know what questions to ask.
Absolutely. And that's why if you look at a webinar and you listen to the questions at the end, or you want to ask some questions, we also have a very good 800 number, which is 1-800-LTC-FEDS. We have program consultants that are very knowledgeable, and you don't sit on hold. They pick up the phone within 20 seconds. And the person that picks up the phone, if you hit prompt one, will answer any questions you have. And they're very knowledgeable not only about our program, but other programs, you know, that are out there, because we have a comparison sheet on our website that encourage people to compare the Federal Long-Term Care Insurance Program with other programs. I mean, the whole idea is we want feds to make an informed decision. What's right for you? And again, insurance may not be right for everybody, nor will this program be perfect for everybody. But as long as you have a plan, then we have achieved our objective. And that's what we get measured on, is awareness of the issue of long-term care.
The other thing, too, I think sometimes people look at this as an investment, and they say, I'm going to pay out all these premiums, and I probably won't need them. And to which I say, huzzah, this is a great thing. If you don't, I mean, you got fire insurance. You don't call home every day hoping your house is burned to the ground. You hope those premiums will be wasted, just as you have car insurance. You don't really want to be in the good hands of Allstate or anybody else.
Fascinating, Mike,
mm-hmm.
Because I get that question all the time. So if I don't use it,
yeah,
what
lost.
Do I get? And I want to say, but isn't that like car insurance,
yeah,
and house insurance and everything else? I think it's just, it baffles me that people seem to feel that they want something if they don't use it. And I guess they don't really get the idea of insurance. I mean, you can be lucky and get to use your whole benefit.
Exactly.
Or you can be unlucky and you can just, you know, die in your sleep and never need it. I am baffled by that because I don't ever look at my, you know, if I don't have a car accident, boy, I'm happy.
I think it's a spinoff of the glasses half full or half empty, because I did a column the other day about how many people in the thrift savings plan have $1 million accounts. And somebody wrote in and they said, yeah, $1 million is nice, but after taxes, it's only $850,000. And emphasis on the only. But thank you very much for being with us today. It's been a very informative show. Check the column for these websites and phone numbers that Joan's given. And we'll talk to you again in a couple of months. Thank you very much, Joan.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Yeah, welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey, and glad to have you with us. That was a nice chat with Joan Melanson from Long-Term Care Partners. A bit depressing at times, but also uplifting in the fact that there are things that can be done if the worst happens to you. Going to be talking now with Andy Medici, senior writer with the Federal Times. Andy, are you with us?
It's always good to be here, Mike.
Oh, good. Yeah. Feared we had phone trouble for a minute. We had a fire drill scheduled, and thank heaven they canceled that. So we're going to have our fully allotted time here today. Hey, Andy, start right off. Another black eye for the Federal Service. The media is all over this story about something like the red team testing in the Transportation Security Administration. And I believe, if the numbers are correct, that 97% of the attempts to get through to breach security at airports around the country were successful.
Right. So what's going on here is that it was a DHS Inspector General series of teams that tried to smuggle through banned items, weapons, fake bombs, those sorts of things through screening checkpoints at airports across the country. And in a remarkably high number of cases, they were able to get through with those banned items. Even in one case, a man who was flagged for additional review had a fake bomb strapped to his chest, and screeners didn't see it, and they let him pass. So you're right, a black eye, you know, and a high profile event that's going on right now as people sort of are closely scrutinizing TSA.
Well, this may be one of those problems that is insoluble, because when you look at the volume, the number of people who fly, I mean, go through an airport like Dulles, which used to be a wonderful place to visit. Now it's a nightmare getting through it. The checks they have to make, maybe there's no solution to this.
Well, this is one of those issues that I think people have always grappled with in the security community, which is, you know, you build a wall, you just have to find one way to get over that wall. DHS and Secretary Jay Johnson has said that, you know, there are other layers to security besides that. You know, obviously security features that they can't divulge, but he has removed the acting TSA chief and reassigned her, and it, you know, is sort of implementing a series of other reforms. For example, you know, continued random covert testing, increased training for all the, you know, TSA officers across the country, and, you know, reviewing all of that security equipment and screening equipment to see if it's really doing the job right. So, you know, maybe some good can come out of it in terms of seeing, you know, what's working and what's not, and really taking stock of how it goes.
Well, I know some of the people in the business say that the problem, I mean, obviously you need to look at passengers, because that's how the 9/11 attackers got on the plane. They came on as regular passengers, but we weren't in the business of being fearful at that time. But they're saying that the real danger is in the airport workers, and the people getting false credentials, or somebody borrowing somebody's key card and just going through, and these are the invisible people at airports.
Well, you know, there have been some behind-the-scenes struggles with this, you know, in the last few years, and, you know, not just airport workers, but even pilots, you know, flight attendants, and, you know, you're right, like maintenance staff at airports, they all get through, and they all have certain levels of clearances, and whether it's too much or too little or how closely you scrutinize them. You know, I think it's hard when you have to figure out the thousands of ways that someone can breach security, and that person only has to figure out one. So it's very asymmetric in terms of the effort involved, and it is a monumental effort to try to secure something as large as an airport.
Well, I remember years ago, long before 9/11, but people were cognizant of security. I think at one point we were worried about being hijacked to Cuba, and then you had the D.B. Cooper, you know, jumping out of the airplane. But this was a time when a Washington TV station, and a very prominent anchor man for that station, did an expose on security at Reagan National Airport, then just National Airport, and they went through with a couple of fake guns, and it showed them putting the guns on and then walking through the line and being pushed, you know, passed through without any big check. And they had a big expose. Well, the behind-the-scenes story that was never told, I found out much later, was that the anchorman, and again, he's the sort of person everybody would recognize on the street. He was a celebrity here. They went over with a crew and worked at National Airport for several days, working this out and meeting people and whatnot. So by the third or fourth day, when they were going to start shooting, and they didn't tell the airport they were going to start shooting, they were treated as old friends. So they let them in as a courtesy and did all these things. They might have stopped them otherwise, but they let them in as a courtesy because they were being nice and this guy was a celebrity. I guess the lesson there is don't trust anybody.
Well, you know, and ultimately that's the issue. It just requires one security breach,
yeah.
And that's what people talk about. So, you know, in a way, it's really hard. And, you know, if anything good comes out of this, it could just be maybe a strengthening of perhaps some weaknesses that were identified.
Right. And those of us who complain about standing in long lines and having to take our shoes off and whatnot, many of that, those are the same people who now are saying that the TSA is not doing a thorough enough job.
Well, you know, it's always that risk, and it's always those issues that sort of heighten people's awareness. So, you know, that kind of backlash is usually right around the corner from these incidents.
Hey, locality pay, something we haven't talked about in a long, long time. In fact, I had to look up some references to it to see, to recall how it worked. It was something that came out of the Federal Pay Comparability Act of 1990, I believe. But you now have about 30-plus cities and metro areas in the United States, Alaska and Hawaii, that where people are paid special salaries based roughly on comparable salaries in the private sector in that area. And at the top of the totem pole, the top of the pay totem pole for Uncle Sam is Houston, Texas, followed by, I think, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Long Beach, and New York. And then you have other cities who pay lesser amounts. Washington is way up there, but it's not the top paid city. On the other half of the equation, you have something called RUS, which stands for Rest of the United States. And these are areas that are outside of the locality pay loop, and these people are paid a flat salary regardless of where they live. The OPM apparently is proposing to expand the locality pay areas. What are they talking about, and what's it going to look like?
Well, that's exactly right, Mike. You talked about the idea that, you know, federal employees in certain areas, they perhaps pay significantly more in housing and, you know, and other items, and you have to accommodate that and be able to recruit federal employees in those areas. You have to pay more, usually a percentage standard applied to the traditional pay scale. But OPM is, after years of recommendations from the federal pay agent and, you know, a council of executives who sort of discuss these issues, they are proposing 13 new pay areas. And you know, these are areas that people have seen before because they've been proposed by the pay agent, and so they're not new. They're just the ones that have been taken up by OPM. They're proposing to expand it to, you know, areas like Albany and, you know, St. Louis and Tucson. And so they put out some proposed regulations that are going to go through the process. But what's interesting is that they're not sticking to the pay agent's recommended increases, you know, the idea of how much more these employees should be making. They're letting that sort of stand vague, leave that up to the administration to really decide in terms of an increase how much that is, which is a little unusual. But, you know, I think a lot of federal employees are just happy that this process is finally moving forward.
And would that have to be approved by Congress and the president, or is that automatic?
Well, no, they're given that regulatory power.
Okay.
Within the pay structure. So, and you know, as we said before, a lot of Congress has given up a lot of their sort of pay authority. You know, the president can do a pay raise if they don't. This is just one of the many smaller ways that the federal government was supposed to be able to adjust pay levels to recruit better people, you know, after all that legislation passed. But we just haven't seen really any action on that in several years.
Well, in the last, of course, the last 3 years, the pay raise has been 1%. And I think the president has proposed, is it 1.2%?
Yeah, the 1.3, I think, percent. But
okay.
Yeah, just above 1%.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how much leeway do you have if you're in or versus out of the locality pay area? I mean, does that mean that people in, say, Washington, say the raise is approved at 1.3% and X amount is applied to locality pay, what would that look like in your paycheck?
It could be a significant amount. It really depends on how closely the administration hews to the pay agent. You know, there are some areas in like Palm Bay, Melbourne, Titusville, Florida area that originally the pay agent had suggested 24% pay differential increase, essentially to accommodate sort of the higher cost of living there. Now, the president and the administration is not obligated to go that high. So it could be any amount, but, you know, even some percentage increases can be significant to a paycheck. It could mean real money in the future.
Well, would the people in these 13 or 20 or whatever it is, these new locality pay areas, will they be made whole? That is, will they be brought up? Will everybody be brought up to a certain level and then start from there?
Well, see, that's an interesting. The implementation is sort of up to the administration. So federal employees, the ideal version is that they start receiving the higher level of pay. But it could be phased in, it could be pushed in over time. So there really is a lot of leeway. And so as we see the regulations evolve and the administration get more involved, we should see at least some clearer details emerging.
You know, after leaving these people in these hundreds of cities around the country, leaving them out in the pay wilderness for years, are you a bit suspicious that 2016 is the effective date and 2016 mm-hmm. is an election year? Or have I been here too long?
Well, I think you're right about the timing, and maybe it's not so much that it's an election year as well, but also that, you know, it's the second term of this administration and they're on their way out. And before, while they might have seen political vulnerability in giving federal employees a pay raise, you know, and as you said before in earlier elections, this could just be an effort to sort of play a little bit of catch up, because there won't be a huge amount of repercussion for this administration. You know, President Obama is going to step down after the second term and, you know, do whatever he wants to do with his life. So giving federal employees in these sort of higher pay areas, higher cost areas of pay raise, you know, I think it's probably that line of thinking instead of specifically the election coming up.
Okay. I mean, there's never been any evidence, despite what some people think, that federal workers vote in a block, you know, whether they're Republican or Democrat. My thinking is that they tend to vote sort of the way the people around them vote. It's a regional sort of thing. But one thing about federal workers, there are a lot of them. They have families. They're all old enough to vote. They're very well-educated, very well-trained group of American workers, and I bet a higher percentage of federal workers vote than maybe many other professions and occupations.
As we said before, it's, you know, it's always a warning to sort of cast federal employees as a monolith, and especially when you look at some of the areas under consideration, I doubt that people in Houston vote the same way as people in Cincinnati or people in, you know, Palm Bay and in Florida. So I think that's always good to keep in mind.
Very good. Anything to wrap up?
Well, I think federal employees should just, you know, stay tuned for what Congress is doing. As you always talk about, Mike, you know, it's always something under consideration until it actually happens. So, you know, let's all pay attention to Congress and what they might be up to this summer. I think it's going to be interesting.
If you had to crystal ball and say that there's one thing that Congress will do that impacts federal workers, what would it be?
I think there's going to be a lot more discussion about contributions to retirement benefits. I think there's going to be a lot of discussion around retirement reform. You know, that's where I think the money is.
Lauren Larson, our producer, is giving me the hook. So thank you, Andy Medici. We'll see you all here next Wednesday. Have a good week.